Good morning. If you turn in your Bibles, please, to Psalm 66. I've had the privilege of giving my testimony many, many times over the years. I feel bad for my poor wife. She gets to hear it again, probably for the 45th time. But there are several texts that I like to turn to somewhat set the table. Perhaps one of my favorite would be Psalm 66 and verse 16. Come and hear, all you who fear God, and I will declare what He has done for my soul. Well, brethren, this text surely sets out for us my goal in this hour. David wanted to say something, and he wanted to say it to a certain group of people. He wanted to give testimony of God's goodness toward him, and that testimony was kind of like a treasure. And he didn't want that treasure shared with just anyone, though it's not wrong, obviously. It's in every way right to testify of God's grace to those who don't fear God. But David was especially interested in this particular verse to share that treasure with those who feared God. Come and hear, all you who fear God, and I will declare what He has done for my soul. Pastor David made reference to some lessons. I have five lessons. I want to work through my testimony and then close with those lessons. Oftentimes, we don't get to the lessons, so I'm going to try to pick up the pace to get to them. But just in case we don't, the fifth one is going to come back to this point that David wanted to share his testimony to God-fearers. And no doubt, at least in part, one reason was to encourage them. And that's a point that I want to come back to, God willing, in a moment. We all, as Christians, have testimonies. And we all, as Christians, have personal testimonies. And as Christians, there's a sense in which we all have the same testimony. God saved us. And notice how David put it. Come and hear, all you who fear God, and I will declare what He has done. See, He has done it, and He's done it in all of our lives. And He's done it in a similar way. He brought us to the end of ourselves, and He brought us to Christ as guilty, filthy sinners. But He's done that in a variety of ways. And thus David says, what He has done for my soul. Brother, I can't tell you what He's done for another man's soul, but I can tell you what He's done for my soul. And hence the phrase, personal testimony. It really makes little difference in one sense if God brings us to Himself through the crack house, the whorehouse, or the White House. He brings us from different places, so we all have a unique testimony. My testimony isn't your testimony in that sense, but He all brings us to the same place, and thus our testimonies are the same. Perhaps I can say our testimonies are the same but different. And it's my high privilege this morning to give testimony to what God has done for my soul. Now, I think I could summarize this with three words, and they all just happen to start with a C. Confusion, and that, of course, would describe my life before I became a Christian. Conversion, and there I want to talk just briefly about how I became a Christian. And then continuation. And again, it's rare to get to the third C, but I want to move through those 3 points somewhat quickly, hopefully, so that I can get to the third C and talk about what God has been doing in my life, in the life of my family and church over these 18 years, and then hopefully summarize everything with some practical lessons. Confusion. A description of my unconverted state. I was born in a non-religious home, but loving. And I had the privilege of having a mother and a father who taught me many good principles. They taught me the necessity of a work ethic. They taught me to show respect to other people, especially older people. I learned all of those from my non-believing father and mother. When I say we were non-religious, I mean we were non-religious. I don't think I ever thought about religion my whole life until I would end up in a homeless shelter where I heard the gospel. And this, of course, would be 20 years later. This would be when I was in my 20s. We grew up poor. You could call us poor whites because we lived in contexts where there were black people and brown people, but all of the whites in our context were poor whites. And I don't mean that to be disrespectful to anybody. If you grew up a poor white, that's just a phrase that we use freely, poor whites. And I learned quickly that privilege comes in all colors. Because those houses in my neighborhood, or those trailers in my trailer park, benefited if there was a mommy and a daddy, or else there was a mommy or a daddy that had some sense. And so if you had a mommy and a daddy that had some sense, or at least one of them, you were privileged and you were benefited and you did well overall. Now, I'm going to contradict that in a sense, because we're going to see that I chose a very wrong path. But I can never impute that. I can never charge my mother and father with my decisions. My mother and father never raised me to be a drunkard, a whoremonger, or a crack addict, to kind of get ahead of ourselves. I did those things on my own. Yeah, there were, in my context, a lot of that, and I gravitated toward it, but that was my choice. So I never speak ill of my father or my mother. My father unfortunately passed in 2010, and my mother is still living up in Michigan. Her health has been poor lately, and so we're hopeful that in the spring of next year she can come down and live with me and my wife. I have a sister who's older and a brother who's younger. Unfortunately, none of them have become Christians yet. Some of you might know that during the middle 80s, especially, crack cocaine became popular in the cities. It hit city life first, and then it eventually moved out even into the suburbs. But initially, the suburbians had to come into the city to get it. And it hit cities like a tsunami. And when I was younger, in the early 80s, I began to smoke marijuana, which led to drinking, which led eventually to crack smoking. I joined the military in the mid 80s because my daddy was in the army for some time. And like some young men, many young men in my context, we didn't give thought to what to do after high school. And so many of us just joined the military. And so I joined the military. We were living in California because we're from Michigan. But when my daddy joined the army in the mid 70s, we got located to California, and that's where I grew up. And so when I joined the military, typically they try to assign you to the same place that you come from, if possible. So we lived in North California, and I was assigned a station down in Southern California. But I was only in the military 2 years. In the latter year, I was incarcerated, not for really any major crimes, but just more minor things like not showing up for work and those type of things. In the military, if you're familiar with the military, that's a pretty serious offense. And so there were a bunch of my friends who were getting court-martialed for more higher crimes, and so they just kept me around for that last year to pick up trash outside on the highway. You've probably seen prisoners do that. So that's what I did for that year. But when I got out, this is mid-80s, that's when I realized that things had altered some in those 2 years, because crack cocaine had become far more popular. It was already hitting the streets when I went in. When I got out, it was, the streets were overrun. Now, I don't need to be overly graphic and particular with things, but I do need to just kind of describe this drug of choice for a second so that you can understand some of the consequences that would come. Crack cocaine is just cocaine condensed in smokable form. And so it's a quick high that doesn't last long. And so it's a unique high. And the problem is that after that first high, you're really just chasing a lie, to use a term we would use, a phrase we would use. Because you're always trying to get that first high that you can never really reach. So because of its addictive nature and its highs, and yet the shortness of that high, people will do anything to get it. And by anything, of course, I simply mean anything. You're going to steal, you're going to lie, there's going to be all manner of sexual immorality. You're basically going to use the resources you have to get it. Now, there's going to be always an exception. There are, I did know some people who could work through the week and smoke up all their earnings over the weekend and then repeat it. But most people, they were not socially functional. We basically lived to get it. So I would be stuck on cocaine, on crack cocaine, from the mid-80s to the mid-90s. And that would mean that I would, when I was discharged from the military in California, I'm from Lansing, Michigan. So I took a Greyhound eventually to Lansing, but it took me several years to get there because I stopped off at certain places along the way. But every place I went, it was the same thing over and over again. So I end up back in Lansing, Michigan. Now we're talking probably about 90 or so, 1990. And I was in the county jail with an 18-year-old. I'm probably 21 or 2 at the time. And this young man was 18, but he did everything and knew everything. And he told me, if you want to get your life right, go to Saginaw. Saginaw is another city a couple hours up north. Go to Saginaw to a place called Teen Challenge. So now, he never told me that Teen Challenge was a religious institution. It's a religiously run drug rehab by Pentecostal Christians. And there's a number of them across the states. And he just told me it's a drug program and it's going to help you get your life straight. So when I got out of county jail, sooner or later, I got a ride to Saginaw, affectionately called Sag Nasty. And when I got to Saginaw, I never even looked for Teen Challenge. The first thing I did is I looked for a plasma center. One of my daughters now sells her plasma, and she gets like $50 or $75 a shot. Back in these days, you got 10 on Tuesday, 12 on Thursday. But it gave me a little bit of money. And unfortunately, in these type of contexts, there's somebody outside the door willing to take the money from you. So I bought a piece of crack. And I, for a few days, I was with a couple people in a city I'd never been in my life. And when the crack was gone, the hospitality left with it. And they told me that the city mission was in walking distance. And so I walked down to the city mission. Now, I had been living in city missions here and there over these last several years. And depending on the type of city mission, it depends on really who runs it and who's the director, really. The mission can be variously religious and nice and clean. Well, if you're from Saginaw and you know about the city mission in Saginaw, it was just that. It was run by men who were largely all grads from Bob Jones University. They were King James only fundamentalists. And so here I am in the city mission in Saginaw. And long story short, they kicked me out from this mission because of my behavior. Because usually missions are divided into two categories. There's the transients and then the programmers. Transients are those overnighters. And they usually put those in, it depends on the mission, but usually one big room. So you might have 50, 75 men in one big room. Now they have, usually in a different place in the building, what we call programmers, and those are people who join an in-house program, some type of drug rehab. Religious, usually, depending upon the mission. And this mission had that. So when I was going to be kicked out, they offered me the option of going into this program, which I would go into for a couple months and still act similarly as I was before, leaving out, sneaking out at night, doing things, and they would eventually kick me out. And they would offer me an option of going to another city mission. They would pay for it. They'd give me a Greyhound ticket. But when they were going to kick me out of this mission and offer me this other option of going into this program, I had to, first of all, be interviewed by the chaplain. And the chaplain was an old Bob Jones man, a good man, a very elderly man at the time. And he took me through the Romans Road. He had me say a prayer. I was very emotional. I was always kind of an emotional person. I mean, my life was a mess. Again, mind you, my mom and daddy didn't raise me to be a homeless drunkard. And so I cry, and he interprets all of that to be sincere tears of remorse, and he pronounces me a Christian. And he puts me into this program that's 6 months long. Now, as I've said, I only make it to the first couple months, and they end up sending me to another mission. But when you're in these programs and these city missions, you have to work around the mission, in the kitchen, in the warehouse, or whatever. Well, the first job that they assigned me was to be a receptionist and to answer the phone at the front desk in the evenings, which there wasn't really anything to do up there, but you just pushed the button when somebody came to the door if you knew that they were allowed to come in. You just pushed the button and they could come in. But I noticed that there was this folder, and on the front of it said, "The Book of Life." And I opened it up and I found towards the end my name. So I went to the chaplain the next day and said, "Why is my name in the Book of Life?" He says, "Because you became a Christian the other day." And I said, "That's what you have to do to become a Christian." I always thought it was more difficult. He says, "Yeah, you said the sinner's prayer." Now, mind you, I'm not religious. I'm beginning to hear about religion in these, you know, while being in the city missions, because everybody there usually is religious in some way. But I had a sneaking suspicion that something was wrong, because all the guys in the program, we were doing all the things we did outside in the streets, but just secretly at night when all the preachers went home. We talked the same, we acted the same, we did everything the same, just secretly. I had a sneaking suspicion we weren't Christians. Well, I did something that was foul enough that they dismissed me. Now, what happened was, there was a man that ran the program, and I'll just give you his name, Daryl. And Daryl got promoted. He was in charge of that discipleship program. He got promoted to be the director of another mission about 3 hours west on the coast of Lake Michigan in a town called Holland, Michigan. Now, I say this and I know it's somewhat comical and it's even embarrassing, but I actually thought I was going to another country. And I'm thinking, can I get there on a bus? Well, apparently they were talking to Daryl and, hey, you remember that guy, Mike Waters? Yes. We're going to have to kick him out because send him to Holland, he said. Send him to Holland. He said, maybe the geographical change will help. Because Holland, if you know Holland or of Holland, it's different than Saginaw. So at that time, the bus station in Holland was in a little liquor store. So when I got off the bus, I got a Slitz malt liquor, 40 ounce, and never made it to the mission. And see, the thing is while you can change your geographical location, and that may even help in some ways, but if you don't change your heart, you're going to end up doing the same things, albeit it may take a little more work to get there. I quickly found all the people in Holland, like me, who knew where to get all the things that we do. Well, eventually I came to the mission, and I was in and out of the mission for several years. I'm thinking I'm going to become a Christian in January of 94. So this is probably 92. So for those couple of years, I'm in and out of the mission. Sometimes into the discipleship program, other times in the transient section. Just think of how nicer it is to be in the program because you have 6 and 8 people in a room as compared to 50 in a room. You have 100 feet in that one, 12 in that one. Big difference. Daryl would sometimes say to me, Mike, we never kicked you out, you kicked yourself out. And there's some truth to that. Now, actually, they did kick me out, but they kicked me out because I was acting in ways that were not lawful to the rules of the mission. And this mission was similar to the one in Saginaw because Daryl was running it. You couldn't just come in and be drunk and stay there, even in the transient section. And even in the transient section, you had to get a job if you wasn't on some type of welfare. And if you got a job or if you had welfare checks coming in, you had to turn them in to the money manager. And he was overseeing where the monies was going. It was actually one of the best missions I've ever seen. But I had done things so wrong so long that they banned me from the property. Now, there was a police station across the street. They moved it since, but it used to be directly across the street. And the police station would let you, as long as you was not violent or overly verbal, sleep in their waiting room. You know, in the wintertime, if it's cold, it's Michigan, obviously, it gets very cold. So we would sleep there. And other places. Sometimes they let me sleep in the doorway of the mission. If I was banned from sleeping there, at least I could sleep in the doorway, in the foyer, and I could sleep there. They'd give me a pillow and a blanket, and I just had to get up when the employees came because they walked over you and they basically just nudge you and say, time to get up, Mike. You gotta go. I couldn't sleep there. I couldn't eat there, but they let me sleep there. But at this point, I was so nasty, I couldn't sleep in the police station or even in the foyer of the mission. Furthermore, I couldn't even come on the property. They said, if I see you on the property, we're going to call the police. So over these 2 years, life goes down. It just gets darker and darker and darker. And I end up living in an apartment with this man that I met from work, sleeping on his couch. I stole and sold his radio for $30. and tried to lie, came up with, it's really, it would be comical if it wasn't so wretched. The lies that we come up with. So he had to kick me out. This is probably December of 93. Now, where do I go? Well, I can keep doing what I'm doing, find a place to stay, or maybe scrape up some monies and take a bus to another city, maybe another state. That's what I've been doing now for nearly 10 years. But there was something going on the inside that kept me from doing that. And instead, I knew that there were people in the mission that genuinely loved me. Now, I would fight with them, curse at them, yell at them, scream at them. But I knew they were right. And I knew that they genuinely cared for me. I knew that all of these people around me didn't care for me. I didn't care for them. They didn't care for me. The employees in the mission, they did care for me. But what am I supposed to do? I can't even come on the property without getting the police called. Well, there was one preacher, he was in charge at this time of that program, Pastor Lauren Piles. Brethren, I've given my testimony probably 300 times. When I would become a Christian, I would go on tour with the director and raise money for the mission, and I loved it. And I could hardly say the name Lauren Piles without getting emotional. There was another minister there named Richard Wyrick. Richard Wyrick was in charge of the shelter, the ES, emergency shelter, we called it, the transients. And the last time that he kicked me out and banned me from the property, he brought me into his office. I can remember it. He opened up his Bible to Luke 15, the story of the prodigal, and he turned the Bible around and he pointed to the verse where it said, "And they gave him nothing." And I remember thinking, this man has lost his mind. The only one that has ability to let me stay isn't, and he's crying. And he said, "Mike, it breaks my heart, but you have to go. And furthermore, you can't come back to eat. And on top of that, you can't even walk on the property." So I cursed him out, left, thinking this is bizarre. But he, as much as I would even become a friend of his after I became a Christian, wasn't that kind of ally. He was more stricter. Pastor Piles was, we would think of him as a big softy. He was probably 6'4", 300 pounds, Southern Baptist preacher. He was a pastor of a church that was just about six blocks away from the city mission. And mind you, he's in charge of this program, so he knew me well. And I knew if I could get a message to him, he might let me back in. So there was an alleyway on the other side of the mission. I waited there until I saw somebody I could use as a messenger. Hey, go tell Pastor Piles I'm out in the alleyway. Finally, later on in that day, he comes. We go up to his office. He asked me, "Mike, what's different this time than the previous times? You've lied to me. You fooled me over and again. What's different this time?" And the only thing I could tell him was, I was beginning at that time to see the emptiness of that culture, that drug culture. I had been in it now for nearly 10 years. And again, it wouldn't be unto edification to be specific. But you're seeing these things that are absolutely wretched. And there was a woman with some young babies, maybe a few months prior, who was going back to the back room with the men. And the little baby said to me, "Are you going to go back there with my mama too? And then I went to the kitchen and there was some bones brewing on the stove with cockroaches. And I thought, you know what? This just isn't fun anymore. You know, when I was a young person, you know, 10, I'd smoke cigarettes and marijuana and drink some beers and then some cheap wine. And it was fun. But now I'm smoking crack with two men, hiding in the bathroom with the lights off, standing in the shower with the curtain closed, with a candle, whispering. Do you hear that? And then, not only that, there's all the stealing, the lying, and then all the immorality. I began to see for the first time how wicked this environment was, how dark this culture is. Now, I would come to see soon that that which was wretched on the outside was too wretched on the inside. But at this, that was the first thing I began to see. And I told him that. He let me stay. He let me sleep for 2 days on the couch. Gave me a room. Now, Pastor Pyles, as I said, was an old Southern Baptist preacher. And he was a four-point Calvinist, dispensational. Kind of a MacArthurite back then. This is very early 94. And, you had classes like anger management and finances and drug rehab stuff and all these kind of things. He wasn't really into all that. He just would preach through books of the Bible for 3 hours. You're supposed to have an anger management class and a financial class and a Bible class. He just preached through books for 3 hours. He'd just give us a 10-minute break in between each lesson. And this is January of 1994. And I'm sitting in a class with maybe 20 other men. And he's drawing on the chalkboard. He's illustrating what he called the Great Exchange. And I can remember it, brethren, as if it happened this morning. He drew a cross, a little stick figure down here, and a little stick figure down there. He drew an arrow from the first stick figure to the cross, a second arrow from the cross to the other stick figure. He says, our sins go to Jesus, Jesus' merit goes to us. Now, I've been hearing that, because you have to go to chapel morning and evening in missions. And I've been in and out of this program, so I've been hearing it, you know, from him, in fact. But for the first time, I heard it. And the Lord opened my eyes. And brethren, I know that not everybody here can pinpoint their conversion. But the Lord saved me at that moment. And I stood up, in fact, and said to everybody in the class, the Lord just opened my eyes. That's my sin being imputed to Christ. And Christ's righteousness received by faith. And some old drunk behind me even moved his hair from his eyes, looked at me, and said, oh, shucks, or something similar to that. He even looked different. The mission in Holland, and this has taken a very long time, the mission in Holland was an old J.C. Penney building, downtown Holland, 166 South River. And so I had a freight elevator that went from the third floor down to the basement. Back then, the program people, men, were on the third floor. The women, second floor, they had both a transient and a program on the second floor. And then the transient men on the first floor. So when the preacher went home at night and all the workers went home, and then basically it was just residents that watched over the floors, we would take the freight elevator to the second floor. Well, that night I didn't go with the man on the freight elevator to the second floor. Why aren't you going? Well, at first I was kind of embarrassed and I made excuses. I got to do this. I got to do that. But the very next day in class, somebody raised the question, what happened to Mike yesterday? Because he didn't even go with us down to the second floor last night. And we woke up this morning and he's in the classroom reading his Bible. I remember one man named Adam who eventually would try to steal the city mission van and sell it for some money to buy cocaine. He would end up going back to prison. A note to the wise, don't steal a van that says city mission on it and try to sell it. He stood up and said, and this is what he said. Now, mind you, this is 94. He said, I think Mike accepted Jesus as Lord yesterday, and we have him only as Savior. Now, I didn't know nothing about MacArthur and Lordship controversy. The preacher did. And I remember standing up and saying, Adam, not to be unkind, but I think the Lord saved me yesterday, and he has yet to save many of you. The change that came over me, brethren, was absolutely tremendous. It was controversial because people wanted to know what happened, but it was radical. I can remember either that very first night or the second, standing in the classroom with the lights off, looking down over the city lights, the street lights, at the snow being blown before them. And I'm weeping. Because I'm wondering, had I never seen snow before? Had I never seen wind before? I remember going to the bathroom and standing before the mirror and looking at my hands and my feet thinking, wow, this is absolutely amazing. I never stopped to think about how it is that you walk upright on your feet. That's actually quite amazing if you think about it. My eyes and my hands. And then, of course, the Bible was an open book. They gave me a fake leather. I would prove it was fake leather because I would wear it off. Pink. Charles Ryrie Study Bible. NIV. And thankfully I read the first half of the page and basically ignored the second half of the page. But I just read from Genesis to Revelation every night. I have a little Bible study. I still have that Bible, and I still have a lot of these notebooks. I would just write out like little sermons, little homilies, little studies. I would just basically trace words through the Bible. You know, I would just study my Bible. And I was seeing as I read it what I would learn later would be summarized as Calvinism and covenantalism. Basically, at the time, I was seeing God saved sinners and that he saves all sinners the same. That's Calvinism and covenantalism in a nutshell. But the thing was, is all the workers saved my preacher. All the workers were Arminian and dispensational. So I would get so excited. I would see, you know, us back there in Isaiah and see how the New Testament quotes it and applies it to us and to Jesus. And I'd come down there showing it to him. Now, Mike, you have to know, this isn't for you. It's for Israel. Well, I began to witness to people. I began to preach. In fact, I preached my first sermon the first Sunday after I was converted. There, we had chapel services on every morning before breakfast and every evening after supper. And on Wednesday mornings, there was a preacher, charismatic preacher, Pastor Tom, who did the devotional. And somebody had told him, Mike got converted. He's not the same. So afterwards, he found me out and said, Mike, I heard you got saved. And he looked at me and he said, my golly, you do indeed look different. Now, you have to take that with some salt because he did a long term in the federal prison system prior to that. I'm not sure for what. And I remember him telling the story once when he was walking shackled that another prisoner said he literally saw a halo around his head. So, but that's another story. But he said to me, what are you doing this Sunday? Going to church. We'll go to our church and preach. So I did. And I was preaching in just on the street corners and to all the men in the mission. And so they thought, you know what? This is a preacher. I mean, they put me in the newspapers, right? Crack addict turned preacher. And so they sent me to a school, a Bible Institute, upstate New York. And I was there just for a couple months, and it just wasn't a fit. Charles Ryrie actually taught 1 Corinthians in this school. And I can remember we had to read his book. I can't think of the name of it, but it had a chapter called Does Jesus Have to Be Lord? And he started by saying no. So I remember after his lecture, there was 500 students at this school. We all sat in the same classroom. Afterwards, he was old at the time. He was lecturing by sitting down. I ran to him quickly after the end of the lecture and had him sign my Bible, which he did. Not this one, but the one I have at home, that Ryrie Study Bible. And then I asked him a question. Dr. Ryrie, you said everybody who gets positionally sanctified, gets practically sanctified, and will one day be perfectly sanctified. Didn't you just say that? Yeah, and he said, but in your book you say that you could skip the second. And this is what he said. I'll never forget it. Mike, you say you've been a Christian, what, 8 months, 10 months? Yeah. I hope to God you grow in grace and knowledge in the next 10 months as you have in the first. And that was it. So I was ready to duke it out. And he humbled me with that response. But I came home for Christmas. Okay, so I'm converted in January. This is Christmas of 94. And I didn't want to go back. But I felt obligated to, because again, I did the circuit. I preached, or I gave testimony and at all the churches to raise money and whatnot. And I came back for this Christmas break with another fellow that had been converted prior to me, which he would actually prove to be a hypocrite and have to go back to the penitentiary. He was actually the best man at my wedding. And Daryl Bartlett, the guy in charge of the mission, the director, pulled me in his office after a few weeks of being back and said, Mike, I'm going to offer you something, and don't answer me, but pray about it. Don't go back. Start working here. We'll work you up into an assistant chaplain, eventually a chaplain. I don't have to pray about it, brother. I don't want to go back. I want to work here. So I stayed there. I actually left all my books and clothing back at the school. I didn't even care. And so I started to work my way up as chaplain, and then eventually our assistant, and then eventually chaplain in probably 6 to 8 months, because the chaplain at the time was a retired evangelical freeman. And he had diabetes, and he unfortunately had to lose a part of at least one leg. And so he had to retire from being the chaplain. And they put me into this position. Here I'm a Christian, less of 2 years, and I'm overseeing all of the counseling, all of the Bible classes, all of the chapel services, all of the tracts that were distributed. I just got all the tracts from Chapel Library and filled up the track racks. I did all the counseling to all the men. I did all of the scheduling to the morning and evening chapel services. And I taught the Bible class, that 3-hour class that I got converted in, because Pastor Pius had grown sick, and he eventually soon died with cancer. So they had another man running it, but I did the Bible teaching. They wised up, by the way, soon after that, and put the women in another building on the other side of town. So then I duplicated my responsibilities to the men, to the women. So now I'm overseeing 4 chapel services a day, counseling all the men and women, and teaching 2 Bible classes. Brethren, that's where I learned theology, to be frank. That's one way to learn theology, teach it. It's not the best, probably. When I was converted in 94, I went out to this school, and I came back. And when I came back, I went back to my church. I figured I could just learn better there with good books. At the time, I had fallen upon all good books. I had Boston Bunyan and all the rest. And I thought, you know what, I'll just go back, read my books, and learn from my preacher. Well, here I am in Sunday school class, and we have this long discussion about what Romans doesn't mean. It can't mean that, said the teacher. I said, but you better go ask the preacher, because he believes it. And I finally just thought, you know what, I got to go to a Reformed church. Now, this is Holland, Michigan. There's a Reformed church on every corner. There's the RCA, the CRC, the PRC, the whatever, whatever. And they were already becoming liberal. The CRC already had lady elders and already believed in theistic evolution. And the RCA wasn't far behind them. And I was Baptist, but I thought, you know what? I never really studied baptism. I was converted by a Baptist. I see it in my Bible. I was baptized as a believer. But if I have to give that up, I'll do so for a more robustly reformed theology. But which reformed church do I go to? We close at 10:30, right? Okay, so we got 8 minutes. Wow. I want to tell this part of it. So I went to the Yellow Pages and looked up churches and looked up Reformed churches. And I found this church called Reformed Baptist Church. And I thought, this is too good to be true. So I called the number and Pastor Mark Chansky answered the phone. And I can remember the first conversation we had. We were talking for about 20 minutes. And they said, Mike, how is it that you, being a recent Christian, relatively a recent Christian, how did you come into such an understanding of all these truths? I said, well, when I became a Christian, the preacher which I was converted under, Pastor Pyles, the first book he gave me was Martin Lloyd-Jones' Exposition of the Sermon on the Mount. And from there, I found Bunyan and the Puritans, and that's what I've been reading. He said, well, Mike, those are the guys we read. And then I said, and then I found, after I was converted a few months, I found in the mission from this, the fellow that I mentioned to you, Richard Ryrick, he was a Sovereign Grace man. I found he would be fired, by the way, but somehow or some way, I found an old tape catalog from Chapel Library. No doubt from him. Maybe he gave it to me. I don't remember. And I remember looking at the end of it, and they had their purpose statement, we exist to exalt the free grace of God and humble the pride of man. I thought, I cannot believe all the sermons in this catalog are by preachers who believe in grace. So, which tapes to order? Because at that time, you could order 10 free cassettes, 10 free sermons a week from Chapel Library. Well, I just happened to choose a preacher by the name of A.N. Martin. And I don't know why I chose it, for two reasons, I think. One, the name seemed cool, A.N. Martin. And secondly, he had a whole lot of tapes. And they all look so good. Now, you only allow 10. Now, some of you know that Jeff Pollard's down there now. But before this, it was R.L. Shelton, Jr. R.L. Shelton. Shelton, Shelton. And I called him and I gave him my testimony. He said, Mike, I only give 10 a week, but I'll give you 11. I wanted 11. There was a 10-part series that Pastor Martin taught on repentance. And then there was this one sermon that was most intriguing. What's wrong with preaching today? So he sent me those. I waited. They came in the mail. And the first sermon I put in was that latter one. I had a little boom box, put the cassette in. My life has never been the same since. Now, this is 94. This is before I left out to go to school. Every week I ordered 10 tapes, and they typically came on Wednesday in a golden little package. And I had Wednesdays off. You know, they would let me, they'd give me a little stipend. You know, I can't remember what it was, $15, $20. And, but I could leave because I was high enough in the program. So I would put my little Walkman on and put the cassette in and typically walk over to Baker Bookstore. There was a Baker Bookstore, and look over the books, spend my allowance up for the week, and listen to a sermon there, listen to a sermon back. I would sometimes sit on my bed and place all the 10 tapes on my bed like treasure. Which one do I get to listen to first? Well, I listen to 10 sermons a week. In fact, I listen to 10 sermons a week from that point onward for several years. But Pastor Mark Chansky said, when I told him, and I'm listening to these sermons by a gentleman named A.N. Martin, he said, "Mike, he's Reformed Baptist." I spoke to him on the phone just last week. So I went there that Sunday and never left. That was 95. My wife had come over in 96 from the Dominican Republic, and I would meet her later that year, and we would begin to date in 97. We would wed in 98, and then we would have babies. We had 2, 1, 1, 1. So we had 4 girls and a boy. And I had always wanted to be a pastor, and that call, that inward call, as Pastor Martin would say in his pastoral theology lectures, has to be driven from, shaped by, gospel incentives. And one of the main incentives that drove me to want to be a pastor was I wanted to give back God's people the whole Bible. I saw the whole book tell me about Jesus and his love. So I made my aspirations known to the elders in Holland. And now I'm working full time at the mission as the chaplain. And so I think it was 99, they agreed, the elders, to send me to Puritan. Puritan's in Grand Rapids. That's about 30 minutes away. Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary with Dr. Beakey. Back then it was just a house. The class was the garage converted. And there was 15 students. I was the first Baptist to go to Puritan. I sometimes joke to Dr. Beakey when I go back, I say, Baptists are like cockroaches. You get one, you're going to get a many of them coming. Because now there's I don't know how many there is now. I bet you there's a fourth of the students are Baptists. Many of the people on staff are Baptists. And so Dr. Beakey allowed me to come. A, it was unique because I was a Baptist. B, I didn't have any education. You're supposed to have an undergrad, right, to go there. I didn't. But he was so gracious. So the class stayed together. So whatever class came next, we all took together. My first class was Homiletics 4. And the interesting thing is that the first lecture of Homiletics 4 is how to preach at and conduct the baptism of an infant. So I went there part time because I still work part time at the church or at the mission. The church was gracious to flip the bill from everything from gasoline to drive out there to even the use of the car. They paid half of my salary. They were very gracious in that regard. And the idea was that they were going to send me out when something came up. And so in 2002, there were a handful of families south of us in Ohio, in Akron, Ohio, who were gathering to hopefully work their fellowship into a local church. Sam Waldron, they found the confession. They called Sam Waldron. He was still up in Grand Rapids. He came down. There were 11 families. He taught the confession, whittled it down to 5. And then they committed, they formed, constituted as a church with 2 deacons, no elders. And so I came down to preach, as did other people. But the first Sunday we came down to preach, it was a fit. And they asked me right then, "Hey, would you come to be our pastor?" I said, "You got to talk to my elders." And so the next year we agreed for me to come down, 2003. And in a trial type situation, a courtship of sorts for 6 months, but they had already voted prior to that, that they would recognize me. But nevertheless, we went through that, I think, proper procedure. They recognized me as their elder. And I've been there as the first elder, now one of three elders in Heritage Reformed Baptist Church, formerly of Akron, and Pastor David, even formerly of North Canton, because now we're in Canton. Now, I wish I had some time to tell you that story, but I don't, because we're out of time. But let me, if I may, just quickly read some lessons. And here perhaps is the big one. We behold the grace, the power, and the faithfulness of God. I was at my darkest when God saved me. Or back it up a little. I was at my darkest when He brought me to a mission to hear the gospel. And then He opened my eyes in the midst of that darkness. Some of you have siblings, spouses, family members in the far country on drugs. Maybe not on drugs, some on drugs, but just living in the world. And you've grown tired of praying for them. Don't stop. God's arm is very long. And secondly, very powerful. He changed me. And I know He changed many of you. Thirdly, He kept me. I've sometimes thought that God's keeping grace is more amazing than His saving. We have five children, three grandbabies. The Lord has prospered the church. The Lord has been faithful. That's perhaps a perfect way to end my testimony of what the Lord has done for my soul. Father, bless Your word and bless this testimony to the good of our hearts. Encourage us, Father, and send us forth rejoicing at Your loving kindness toward us. And then we ask that You'd gather us here in 30 minutes or so, pour out Your Spirit upon us and help us to worship You in spirit and truth for the sake of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Amen.